This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3578 for Wednesday, the 20th of April, 2022. Today's show is entitled Linux and Laws SAI, Electronic Freedom Never Mind the Civil Rest. It is part of the series Linux and Laws. It is hosted by Monica Mick and is about 87 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is a discussion with members of the Electronic Frontier Georgia about electronic freedom, civil rights.
This is Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Welcome to Linux In-Law Season 1, Episode 54, I think, Martin. How are things in the kingdom?
They are very windy, yes. But probably not so much in Germany, right? You've got Holland in between before he gets there. So.
I understand that Lizzie has caught a tooth today or over the weekend. Lizzie sent me a mail saying, sorry, I got a tooth.
Yeah. Yeah, so she can't make it on the show, I'm afraid.
But. Yes, for those people who are not in the loop, we are talking about the Queen of the Kingdom, who apparently has caught COVID on the outstretch, I'm afraid. Lizzie, if you're listening, you may, I hope this is over by now, because we may release this a little bit kind of later than we actually recorded. But this is not about COVID or Queen Elizabeth, unfortunately, I might add. Because I reckon I speak for Martin too. We are just at the very bottom of our heart. We are loyal. We are not only loyalists, but we are royalists too, right? Martin, I'm joking. We're not. But this is not about the royals or the kingdom or some other.
No, not really.
But this is rather about the Georgia Electron. Before I get this wrong, guys, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'll start. This is Scott Jones. I'm acting director of Electronic Frontiers Georgia. I've been, Electronic Frontiers Georgia was founded in 1995. I've been active in it since 96. And this is essentially, it's a hobby. And my day job, I'm a system administrator and I have been a developer in the past. So I'm, I am familiar with technology. I've worked in technology for quite some time.
Excellent. Over to you, Chuck.
Okay, Chuck DeLozier. I am with Electronic Frontiers Georgia. When it has been, when we've needed it, I have called myself the community outreach coordinator or things of that nature. I have been the person who's gone out to reach out to a lot of different groups that are doing other work that are not necessarily technology related, but find that in the work that they're doing, whether it's some type of political issue or maybe it's with homeowners, wherever they are, they find that technology is in their lives. And so I wanted to try to be a liaison to get them more involved in the kind of work that EFGA is interested in at a state and local level, which is defending civil liberties and privacy.
And that is Keith.
Keith Watson. I just recently retired from Georgia Institute of Technology, where I was the head of information security for the College of Computing. I'm a GIOC certified incident security incident handler. In my original life, I was a submarine Navy electronics technician working in cryptography and signals intelligence. I used to sponsor, when I was at Georgia Tech, a capture the flag team for them. I'm co-founder of Atlanta Lock Sport. So if anybody's into lock picking, I love lock picking. I also host the local chapter of DEF CON here in Atlanta called DC 404. I'm a moderator of the Atlanta Cybersecurity Engineers Discord server and a member of Atlanta 2600 chapter. And I'm also a co-developer of a capture the flag called Network King of the Hill, where we host monthly capture the flags at DC 404 and at 2600 meetings when we're not in the middle of COVID. So when we get back to meeting in person, we'll go back to hosting those.
I've known Chuck
for many, many years. And Scott, I've known, actually Chuck, I've known you for a while too. Scott, I've known for many years. And when he told me about EFGA, I immediately volunteered for working with them. Primarily, I do evaluation of bills that come online. This year, we've got a spate of them that all relate to privacy, security, online safety, that sort of thing. So governments tend to measure with micrometer, mark with chalk, cut with axe when it comes to their bills. So we try to give them some semblance of guidance in regards to information security and privacy, so that the bills don't cause more damage than good. That's the basic idea.
And before we go into the background of the EFGA, let me rant a little bit about the beautiful South, never mind, Georgia Tech. And I'm more than pleased to have actually somebody from Georgia Tech on the show, because that brings back more fond memories while traveling through Georgia and Atlanta specifically. Guys, we are more than happy to have you on the show. But enough ranting. Why don't we start? Because I reckon there are about two listeners out there who do not know what the Electronic Frontier is, never mind the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So why don't we go into a little of the history about the EFF and the EFGA in general?
Okay, let me start talking about the EFF. EFF is the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It was started in, around 1990, or based on events that happened around 1990. There was a small gaming company called Steve Jackson Games. They're still around, but they got raided by the Secret Service. And they were innocent at the time, but I think there was a lot of concern about we had this new technology coming in, and we had law enforcement that didn't understand it at all. And so the founders of Electronic Frontier, the people got together and eventually decided there needs to be an organization that would speak on behalf of people in the technology sector and people who were working in technology who had issues with their rights. And a couple of people got together and founded Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's often been called the ACLU of cyberspace. And the mission is, kind of at the intersection of technology, civil rights, and the law, and how the law interfaces with technology. We find a lot of times, even today, years later, we have legislators, judges, that other people that in positions of influence and power, they don't quite get how technology affects people's rights, and that's been part of the problem. And so that's kind of been why EFF needed to be created or founded. So again, we have an American organization called the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU. And EFF has often been compared to the ACLU, but they're dealing with technology and technology related issues. And so they have been called the ACLU of cyberspace. Go ahead.
Full disclosure, people, I'm an active sponsor of ACLU for the simple reason that I believe in their goals. So let's forget about the EFF. Let's talk about American
civil rights and other stuff formulated. I'm joking.
I'd be more than happy to talk about that, actually.
No, jokes aside. I reckon we'll lose our final listener in that case. But no worries. So let's go back to the EFF. But I find the analogy to the ACLU quite more than fascinating, actually, because I fully concur. These two organizations have a lot in common from a, I wouldn't say philosophical perspective, but almost. And I probably will get shot for this, from a communist or socialist perspective. But we go into that, I reckon, in a minute, with regards to freedom of ideas and all the rest of it. Sorry?
You mean they share the same principles, right? It's, I think, what you're trying to say.
Exactly, yes. Martin, why? Because you are actually one kind of the prototypical communist on the show. Why don't you chip in now for a change?
No, I'm not really.
Just go ahead.
Not a real communist. I don't think we need to bring political preferences into the.
Oh, we do, Martin. We do.
No,
we probably do. It's hard to get away from that in Georgia.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. I like this.
By the way, for anybody who's listening to this and interested in that original case with Steve Jackson Games, there's an excellent book called The Hacker Crackdown. You can get it on Amazon. It might be available free now on Gutenberg, but it's about that entire case. The interesting thing about the book is it's written from both sides of the issue. The author wrote from the perspective of the people involved and from the perspective of the government and how they collided and the aftermath of all that occurred. It's a really interesting read.
Wow. Okay. Why don't we kind of shed a little bit more light, like 2 more minutes, on the EFF, its origins and the history before we go into the EFGA in more detail and your aims, ambitions, world domination, all the rest of it.
So you want to know more about the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
Yes, because I reckon that at least 4 listeners maybe haven't come across the EFF in that level of detail. We did a show on the OSI about, what was it about, half a year ago? Yes. Maybe something like this. We also had somebody from the FSF Europe on the show. But the EFF all kind of has escaped us so far. But now that we have you on the show, apart from the Georgian kind of focus or focal point, rather, why don't you shed some light on the EFF history and that sort of thing, if you are game?
Well, I'm not really totally, completely qualified to talk about the history per se, but I would say when you mentioned Free Software Foundation, Europe or wherever they are, I think the Electronic Frontier Foundation is focused more on the law. And they do have a lot of lawyers who go over a lot of technology-related legal cases. And what the EFA, the Electronic Frontier Alliance, which is our group, the Electronic Frontiers Georgia, many similar names, and you have to keep them all straight. I think that what is another piece of the EFF's history that is noteworthy is that they have created the Electronic Frontier Alliance to enable groups all across the United States to form of their own accord and to be citizen advocates and citizen activists. That's how I found Scott, and eventually, because of Scott, that's how I found Keith. And that's where, you know, you can be an average person like me who, while I did go to Georgia Tech for a while and I was in a design program and architecture, my background is not, you know, technology related per se. I'm more of somebody who's a hobbyist and very interested. And so the Electronic Frontier Foundation has enabled someone like me to learn from the kind of issues that it highlights on its website at EFF.org. We'll plug that. And it also allows me to meet people that are like Keith, who is an ex-military, a person who has worked for many, many years at very high levels in technology, and someone like myself and many of the other people that we meet in the at EFGA events would never have the opportunity to meet someone like that, or Scott, that in a systems administrative position. And so the EFA has allowed people to come together. And I think that's something that we should highlight here about both our group here at the state level and what the Electronic Frontier Foundation has done across the country.
So is it fair to say that the EFA bridges somewhat the gap between, I'm exaggerating now, but bridges the gap between the EFF and some of the aims that the ACLU stands for?
Yes, yes. In fact, we as a group here, Electronic Frontiers Georgia, will contact the ACLU, and the ACLU will contact us, because we will be able to provide support to one another. And I know that from other, you know, conference calls that I've been on with over just either as a viewer or sometimes as a participant, that happens across the country. I mean, I've learned about technology related issues in California because of the EFA groups hosting something that the ACLU of California has done, or for instance, and things like that. So it really is a kind of an umbrella that is bringing a lot of different groups together.
Great.
Excellent.
Martin, sorry, yes, I got a question too.
I was going to ask, so you, all three of you have come up at the angle from a technology perspective, and you're looking at laws and bills. How do you get around all the legal speak? Or do you have lawyers in your group as well, or are you able to deal with that angle of the review as well?
Well, we actually don't have, this is Scott. We actually don't have attorneys on staff. We do have attorneys who have volunteered their time and energy at times. They had either worked for gratis or maybe for very low rates on certain cases that they felt were important, where it is important to make a precedent or some situation like that. But again, we don't have any staff attorneys or anything like that, and we are kind of light on the legal expertise side. But the good news is that through the Electronic Frontier Alliance, we have a connection to Electronic Frontier Foundation, where we can talk to their attorneys at least indirectly, or we can discuss a particular problem that we may have. They can run it by their legal department, and they can come back to us and give us some advice on the legal side. Now, we do know local attorneys here, but so with the local attorneys, they're basically doing it nights and weekends kind of as a favor to us, whereas Electronic Frontier Foundation, it's their day job, so they're able to jump on things more quickly. And we do, we do talk to some of the other organizations in town, including ACLU of Georgia, the Georgia chapter, and they have staff attorneys as well. So we have access. We don't have attorneys on staff with us or attorneys that are 100% dedicated to our group, but we do have access when we have a legal question.
And also, it's not impossible to understand legal issues. People assume that it's written in some strange language we can't read. It's actually written that you can't understand it. Sometimes you have to look up terms. Over time, as you expose yourself to it, it becomes more accessible. So I'm an advocate for just jump in and start somewhere, read about it, learn about it. As citizens, we have some responsibility to be involved in the process. By definition, well, here in the United States, our government is sort of predicated on the idea that the government should have limited power, and what power it does have, it should be observed and monitored at all times, and it is our duty as citizens to make sure they're getting it right.
Okay.
And if we don't, and something goes wrong, it's our fault for not having intervened. So
it may be perceived from abroad, but
it's different. I realize that in other countries, they're going to look at this like, I've got three heads. That makes no sense to them. So I understand that. I've lived abroad, so I do get that it's very different in other places. There's, in the case of the United States, we're called upon to actually be directly involved. Most people don't pick up and run with that. We have the opportunity to do so, and it impacts all of us. There have been some very bad laws that got passed, the DMCA, the can't think of it right offhand, the cyber crimes bill that was passed, that have some very, very bad side effects that are still being worked out. Recently, we had one 2 years ago called SB 315, which was going to criminalize cyber research in simple terms. Like if I noticed that a website had a vulnerability, I just happened to notice that, and I reported it, then I could be prosecuted for criminal hacking. And so we were able to get the, working with not only the FGA, but a great number of other people chimed in on that bill and was able to get the governor to veto the bill. So that would have caused all kinds of havoc. There was a recent case here in the U.S. where a reporter noted was looking at a website and pressed F12 to view the source code, which is not an uncommon thing to do, and noticed that on the web page it didn't show up, but in the source code it had the social security numbers of all the people working there. So he reported it. Yeah, and he reported it, and the governor of the state wanted him prosecuted for hacking, criminal hacking.
Now, sweet.
Yeah, and so everybody in the industry, people like the EFF, also other cybersecurity experts in the country, said, no, governor, I don't think you understand, and explained what F12 does, and that viewing source code is not criminal hacking, and that he was completely offline. And he doubled down and said, no, no, I want him prosecuted. And it went through several rounds of that. And eventually, just recently, I think 2 weeks ago, the prosecution in that state said they were not going to pursue the case. And so the governor still wants him prosecuted, but the prosecutor said, no, we're not pursuing that. But those are the kinds of problems.
Father, new rules, yes.
Yeah, you know, sometimes legislature wants to do, now mind you, this is a bit hyperbolic, but they'll want to do things like math is too hard with pi being an irrational number. Couldn't we just make it 3 to make it easier? And they do the equivalent of that with some of the bills and that they try to pass related to technology. They don't really understand how the technology works quite often. In fact, there's one bill I'm reviewing currently where, in essence, the bill says, insert magical technical wand here to solve all our problems. And that's, sorry, that doesn't work that way. Or AI will fix our problem. Well, AI isn't a magic bullet. It doesn't fix everything. It doesn't solve those kinds of problems. And quite often we find out it can't be relied upon in the way that we think it can. So those are the kinds of issues we deal with in talking to the legislators and trying to get them to understand the technical underpinnings of what's actually possible and those things which should be moderated and those things which should not be moderated.
But Keith, you see, at the end of the day, despair not, I'm tempted to say, because there is hope at last. For example, I mean, I'm a great admirer of, for example, the American Constitution, because the people who wrote the American Constitution knew what they were doing. And this is a red line that goes through your legislation at the end of the day. For example, you can only do 2 terms. So at the end of the day, Trump had a maximum of 8 years. I hope it stays at 4. But that's my personal opinion. The point that I'm making here is, guys, you just have to take a close look. And this is federal legislation, this is state legislation. You have more checks and balances that you know of, or that the common Joe blog in the street perceives. And there's light at the end of the tunnel, that's what I'm saying here. And if you read your constitution carefully, it's already built in the whole thing on a constitutional level. Of course, there are things broken, like the Electoral College. Yes, sorry, I'm derailing completely here, but hear me out. The Electoral College, and correct me if I'm wrong, was built at a time when the population was quite different in the US because you had much more people living in rural America than you had now. So the Electoral College reflects a state of the nation about 200 years ago. There is no really, there's no surprise really that now, of course, with the whole shift in the overall a population spread, that this is not adequate at the in modern times, let's put it this way. So Bernie Sanders and friends do have a point when they say the structure is broken, but I'm tempted to say the whole idea is still valid. Of course, I'm derailing now because this is not a podcast on American history, but the point that I'm making here is quite straightforward. Your country has a lot of things going for it, and your constitution, never mind the things that come out of it. And Keith, what you're saying there just makes the point. It still applies.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In the fact that it still applies, there's a whole debate over the validity of the our election system right now. In fact, one of the things that we've had to deal with over and over and over again is our election process. In fact, I've had to go to battle multiple times now over how we do our ballot counting, what machines we use, the process we use. And the most common thing that comes up constantly is when somebody says, we put a man on the moon, why can't we vote online?
Valid point.
And the problem is they don't actually understand the underlying things that voting has to do. In other words, what are called constraints. I would run into this all the time with students at Georgia Tech, where they would say, why can't we do X? Because from their point of view, the constraints were very minimal, and they just don't understand all the things involved that are trying to be solved. And if they did, they'd come to a completely different conclusion. And on the surface, it looks simple. So an analogy would be, we put a man on the moon, why can't we build a bridge from California to China? And you say, well, wait a minute, you realize the ocean's deep and we have limits on material technology and construction methodologies, and there's things like shipping lanes and hurricanes, or in their case, typhoons in the Pacific. And there's all kinds of mitigating issues that you're not taking into account. It's not like technology can wave a magic wand and solve all problems. If we put a man on the moon, why haven't we cured cancer yet? You could easily say that as well. Or why haven't we cured COVID yet? We put a man on the moon. Those are the same kind of arguments. Well, those are the kinds of simplistic mindsets that commonly crop up in these bills. They're trying. They're just, you'd think they're not trying hard enough. One of the things I've noticed, and I always kind of thought of this at first when I started doing this, was I was doing the legislators' homework for them. Isn't this their job to research this stuff and find this stuff out? Well, I then looked at how many bills actually, just in the state of Georgia, there are several hundred, when I say several, 500-600 bills per session for the state, for the House and the Senate. So there's like 500 plus bills in the Senate, 500 plus bills in the House. Some number of those percolate to the surface, get some amount of viewing, get voted on, pass over and cross over to the other side. Some process goes through, and some of those come out the other end and actually become bills or laws that get signed by the governor or vetoed in some cases. That is astounding amount of work that the legislators are responsible for, and there just isn't enough time in the day to be that level of expert necessary on all those subjects. So when it comes to things like electronic freedom, privacy, and security, that's where the EFG comes in and acting as a source that they can rely on to give them that kind of in-depth technical understanding of what they're trying to do. And that's the problem. We can build technology which takes a great deal of depth of understanding to do correctly. And technology is a force multiplier. It is very difficult and takes exceptional focus and detailed work to get it right. In that case, it's a force multiplier for good. But on the other hand, it's really easy to get it wrong. And when you get it wrong, it's a force multiplier for bad. So we've got it going against us in that it takes hard work to get right. It's easy to do it wrong. And by simply not paying attention to all the constraints and making assumptions like we put on a man in the moon, why can't we do X? Those kinds of things can lead to disaster. So we try to prevent that as much as possible and try to put some sanity in that process. And it's all up to volunteers. Nobody makes us do this. We hope that other people would join us. And by the way, if anybody's listening to this, would like to join EFTA, feel free. The membership constraints are really, really heinous. You have to like show up and care. That's basically it. So
links will be in the show notes, of course. Yeah. People, yes, I couldn't have put it better, but at the end of the day, I'm almost tempted to add here, and this is kind of the eternal debate now. Would you rather prefer the legislation to come down from the Hill, as in Washington, D.C., or being done on a state level? I mean, let me take a step back here. There are two types of nations on the planet. I'm exaggerating now, but you know what I mean. Centralistic ones, like the Kingdom, like France, like Russia, what remains to exist, of course. And there are also other types of nations, like federal, like Germany comes to mind. Of course, the U.S. and other nations that have a more federal system in place. Both types have the advantages and disadvantages. But at the end of the day, I reckon the federal system, and this is my personal opinion, has a slight advantage because it's more democratic. At the end of the day. May sound to be corrected, fair enough, but...
Well, Go ahead, sorry. Okay, I'll say this about it. Because the internet is kind of ubiquitously everywhere at the same time, and so it seems like if you're regulating it, it would make more sense to do it at the federal level. But we found that special interests who can't get their way at the federal level will try to go to the states and get what they want with the state. Get what they want from the state. So in other words, if you can't pass it at the federal level, if you can go pass it 50 times at the state level, you can essentially get a de facto federal bill. But sometimes that's bad legislation because it favors a particular special interest and is really not in the general public interest. So that's a tactic that you see sometimes within the states with respect to state legislation versus federal legislation. However, on the other hand, there are times when the activist community is wanting to try out a legislative initiative or something like that, and they start at the local level first, and then they go to the state level if it succeeds at the local level, and then maybe they take it from the state level to the federal level. So there's good reasons and maybe not so good reasons to change what I might call the scoping as to whether it's local, state, or federal. But ultimately, the internet is kind of ubiquitous everywhere, and a consistent model is helpful because it's pretty much the same everywhere.
One last interjection here. Of course, on the federal level, you have a concentration of funds because it's easier to lobby on a federal level than on an individual state level. It goes without saying. So, if you just put a couple of millions onto the Hill, you can save billions on the state level. I'm joking, but you know what I mean.
Well, this is a really good. This is a really interesting topic, actually, because there's theory of what's better, a centralized or a federated system. One of the advantages of a federated system, and a good analogy of this, is imagine all the products and services you use in your life. Are all of them provided by, to pick on Apple, are they provided by Apple? And the answer is no, and that's because Apple hasn't invented or thought of every product or service that you want to have. They've thought of good products and services, but not all the ones that you would want. So when you get into a centralized system, you end up with a one organization trying to come up with solutions for everything. Well, if you think about it, all the solutions that we have in life today are not, were not created by a centralized system. They were created by individuals somewhere who had an idea and ran with it and got a bunch of other people who said, hey, I like that idea too, and joined in on it. And it eventually became an Apple or a Microsoft or a company in some cases, or just a good idea in other cases. So, and the good idea spread. Well, the minute you say that we're no longer going to allow those decentralized ideas to flourish in a sort of an intellectual marketplace, that it all has to come from the central location, well, that assumes that that central location will invent, think of, and solve all the problems from all the myriad ways that all those people managed to come up with throughout history. And that's not a possible solution. So it's kind of like saying, rather than using this gigantic multiprocessor supercomputer we have called the world and all the individuals in it, let's just use one IBM x86 computer down in the basement of some government building instead. And that's just by design not a good idea. You won't come up with all the novel and incredible solutions that people are able to come up with. Now, neither system gone to extreme is the solution. You need some marrying in the middle. And that's where this whole process of the EFGA and government comes in. There are some things that you do want to bubble, take those ideas and take them to the middle and use them in a at a government centralized manner. And that's where you create a law. And there's other things you want to just let be done at the local level. I'm pretty sure that where I live and I have all kinds of wildlife in my backyard, that they do not want the same rules here that they want in a lockdown dog park in the middle of Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles. Obviously, we couldn't even manage the wildlife here like you would a dog park where everything's on a leash and has to have somebody pick up after it. You can't do that with wildlife in the backyard. So those are examples of things that only work at a local level at a specific location and don't work universally everywhere.
So Tim Cook, if you're listening, Stalin and Lenin are not role models. Do not do as they did. I'm exaggerating, guys, but you know what I mean.
That is a precise example of the problem. In fact, because Stalin decided to make it a centralized system, they caused this massive famine that killed a whole lot of people. When they had a working distributed system that worked, and they decided to kill it and go to a centralized system, and it had unintended consequences.
Yes. Sorry, Martin, but I'm digressing.
Well, I would jump in and say the one thing that I've heard everyone say in the last few minutes is that it is about product and service, which I can understand some of that argument that, you know, you can't ask for that to be filtered through or audited somehow with one central location at the federal level, maybe here in the United States, if we were using this as an example. But I would say that the governance of things, I think a lot of what I see happening where it impacts a person's life, technology and surveillance, I think the governance of that is very important. And I think a lot of the missteps happen is at a state level, because that's when states who, for whatever social reason or some other type of reason, will do their own patch on something. And that's maybe an area where the internet, if we want to just call it the internet, I guess, I guess everybody kind of stumbles over what terms to use. But I think that kind of federal level governance or coming up with a set of guidelines is something that we're greatly lacking. And that is, that's something that will end up having a lot of unintended consequences, because the things that will be reactionary that will happen at a state level will mean that if you live in these states, you will be able to act accordingly or be treated in one way, and you will have different experiences if you live in another. And for me, the kind of utopian vision of the beginnings of the internet world that we're all growing up and living through now, It's more fractured because of that type of arguing without that overall kind of governance. And I don't have an answer for how that should happen, but I know that the United States is needing desperately to step up its game and start looking at things at a federal level and not allowing personal information, medical, private information that they claim is always protected by HIPAA and some other laws that we have here in the United States, or other very personal private areas, to be collected and data harvested out to whoever the highest bidder is. And states are acting on that, or they're purposely not acting on that. And your life experience is very different depending on where you live here in the United States, because we don't have a federal guideline for how the internet is involved in our personal lives. I hope that kind of made sense.
Yeah, and Chuck, you've touched on a recurring problem that we run into all the time regarding these kinds of laws. The internet moves at this, you've heard, moves at the speed of internet. It's microseconds. Things change constantly and in ways that we could never anticipate, and extremely quickly. Unfortunately, people don't respond that fast when it comes to policy, procedure, and governance. An example is Henry Ford decided to use this newfangled idea that he did not invent. It had already been around a while, called the assembly line. And everybody in business at the time told him that was crazy, that will never work, that will be an utter failure. 50 years later, they were teaching in a business school that if you weren't using an assembly line and those kinds of methodologies in your practices, you were brain damaged. But it took 50 years.
Nice.
So at the speed of the internet, colliding with 50-year cycles or changes occurring in generations or 20-year increments, you're going to have a collision. You're going to have a lot of noise and problems and issues that arise as a result of that massive difference in speed at which these two things occur. And that's part of what we're dealing with, is stuff's changing so fast, we literally don't have time to absorb what is the potential impact of this, what impact would we like it to be, and then the third problem is, well, wait a minute, will that device or technology actually do what it was intended? And that's the idea of hacking in the original sense is, which I deal a lot with, is discovering the difference between what something was designed to do and what it is capable of. And sometimes that what it is capable of can be a good thing. For instance, using a screwdriver to open a can of paint, that's a good thing because you don't have the actual tool necessary to open a can of paint. For those who don't know, there is a tool made for opening cans of paint, but a flathead screwdriver will work just as well. Well, that's hacking because that wasn't the intended use of the screwdriver. Now, that's a simplistic idea of it, but, well, wait a minute, would that cause a problem if suddenly using a screwdriver to open cans of paint caused an unintended consequence and that would require legislation to fix it? That might take a while. Well, when you're talking things like coming out with baby monitors that are open to the internet that anybody can access, they do a Shodan search. Shodan is a service, by the way, Shodan. To find all the cameras and they can use it for some nefarious purpose? Yes, that has happened and happens regularly. Well, do we need legislation to say that if you're building a baby monitor, it actually has to be safe, not just says it's safe on the package, that it actually has to be safe, and there's a standard for what that safe is? Well, now you get into this political debate that takes 20 years. In the meantime, they've sold 5 billion baby monitors. A classic example of that is Android phones. There's billions of Android phones out there that are currently have multiple root accessible remote access holes in them, security-wise, that cannot and never will be patched, that are going to be in service for years. And there's nothing that says when they built those that they had to think of that in advance. And that's the problem, was now that there's billions of phones out there, they can be leveraged to do some pretty heinous things. What do we do with that? That's just one technology. That's just one device, one operating system from one company. Multiply that by the number of companies, the number of devices, and the rate at which we could build new ones, you got a serious problem on your hands. That's where the EFGA comes in to try to help with that problem. Try to think through that ahead of time. Give our legislators a heads up. And things that the EFGA does, we get ideas from other groups in other states. For instance, if you have a state that comes up with a really good template for a really well thought out privacy legislation, we'll get wind of that through the EFF, and then we can suggest that as a model for our state to use. And if enough states do that, at some point, as Chuck was saying, the federal government might step in and say, you know what, there's so much fracturing here, we're going to come up with an overarching one that takes precedent over all this privacy and give privacy to everybody, not just the states that were ahead of their time that managed to give it to their citizens. We're going to give it to everybody. That's the kind of thing that should happen. Now, whether or not that does or not, that's another issue. But we'll try to help with that process. Boy,
I want to tell you, because you were kind of touching on this, and Keith was kind of backing up what I was saying. I don't know completely what's happening in Europe, but I do follow, you know, some different groups. I bookmark a whole lot of things. But, you know, what Keith is talking about, like eventually after the fracturing, that the federal government here in the United States may step in. You know, in the meantime, all of this percolation that we're talking about with technology helping different IoT devices come online. We have sensors in refrigerators, as you know, I'm sure your listeners know all of this too, with like in thermostats and all over the place. But the problem is that we have to wait for all of these things to be problematic enough and fractured enough before the federal government comes in and tries to really study something. And it's granted, they're not smart enough and they don't have the expertise in that, but it is no excuse that they're not smart enough that they haven't asked many, many expert people, because look at me, I don't have a degree in computer science and I'm a part of a group of civil libertarians and I get to hang out with other people and I've had the gumption to do this, like, oh, I don't know how to do this. So I may ask Keith and Keith says, I don't know how to do that either. Why don't we try this? Well, let's ask this other person because they do know this. Did you know that guy is like a nuclear somebody? No, I didn't. And so you literally can't find the genius all around you. And I don't understand why we give the government an excuse to not do that. Meanwhile, you know, your thermostat is being looked at by the service provider, and you know, nobody's bothered to say to the poor guy that's there, you know, do you realize that you're taking all of this information about all of these households and just passing it on to the rest of, you know, whatever it is on the other end, and we don't know what they're doing with that. And some of that may sound, you know, dark and bleak, and it, maybe we laugh about it a little bit because we shrug our shoulders, we don't know what to do. But at some point, people around the world are going to find themselves very unhappy, I feel, with that kind of backlash that happens while we're waiting to catch up, while we're waiting on our governments around the world to catch up to things. And I would close this comment by saying one thing that I have found that I think might be hopeful and interesting is, I don't know if you all have followed the elections in South America, that Chile has a new young president that they did not expect to win. And I was reading about them redoing their constitution in Chile. And one of the interesting things that they have decided to put in their discussion, I guess it's a long process, is they're going to be talking about neural rights. And I found that to be extraordinarily timely, because that is another frontier of data harvesting that will take place, because you will have many, many more medical devices of the future that will be doing brain-computer interfaces and all kinds of things in the telehealth space. And neural rights will be kind of a concept that we're going to hear more and more about in the future. And I thought that was brilliant that the new, I don't know if the new president is behind it specifically there, but I know that it's being talked about in the Constitution that they're reworking right now. So I found that that was interesting, that maybe a young group of people will be the ones to lead the way into the future.
It's not very advanced.
So Mark, go ahead. But before we do this,
advanced, very, very advanced, the Chile story that you told us.
But on this particular note, Chuck, I don't know if you're familiar. I think it was Kay Chapman of the Software Freedom Conservancy who says actually, or required on a federal level, that the software of pacemakers has to be open sourced, because that exactly goes down that alley.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And we don't want to find with those types of things that we are trying to play catch up. And so we need to be serious about it at a government level. And we don't need to just, you know, we don't need to sow fear and doubt and uncertainty about it all. We need to actually be solving problems and advancing the future.
In that case, exactly. Just make it a legal requirement. And I think the bodies in the states do an excellent lobbying work here now in a very positive sense. That exactly that the organizations like the Software Freedom Conservancy basically lobby for this on a state as well as federal level. And it does make sense because same thing goes for cars, same thing goes for medical equipment. If it's open source, everybody can take a look at it and come up with the flaws, if you're inclined to do so. Sorry, if it's closed source, you cannot simply do this. Sorry, Martin, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say the same thing. In fact, what you're doing is doing the same. What open source software is all about is being able to review the laws instead of the code, and have many people looking at them with their expertises to give a good opinion on whether something is sound or not, as the examples you mentioned. And you can never achieve this by, you know, originally you can think, oh, the government or the state needs to hire more experts in this area, but you're never going to be as good as the collective right to that has many more eyes and many more viewpoints and expertises on this on any of these things. So I guess that kind of makes the case to how big is your organization and how many people do you rely on to do these kind of things, right? If you know, if it's just two people that look at some laws or 200, that makes a big difference, right? So I guess that makes the case for all your organizations in the same vein. But are you actively trying to increase these numbers, or as you mentioned, Chuck, you rely on people that you know as well for certain expertise as well? But
I think my answer is the answer that we always have, which is yes, we would always welcome more help. It is very challenging to do. You know, people are very busy in doing that, and I think that you know, when you find young people that are in the college age, university level, or just right thereafter, there's a lot of energy, and that's a good recruiting ground. And then you always find a good recruiting ground with people who are nearing or you know, going into retirement as well, because there's extra time available, and it's when you're in between those two spots that it's harder than ever to do it. But one of the things that I think that Electronic Frontiers Georgia and other groups I've heard from try to do is do outreach in different ways for different groups of or different demographics or ages, perhaps, in ways that will be accessible to them. And I think, you know, I think Keith had said for the 404 meetings that we have here in Atlanta that we may do a hybrid when we're able to go back, and because we're able to interact differently with people doing the video than we do when we would meet in this public space, which, you know, you may not be able to make every meeting, but you could dial in. And that wasn't always the case. And so I think that's going to be part of what we will have to do, because what we're interested in started out for me just a few years ago, even as something that I did not have the opportunity to get involved in. I had to read on the internet about laws that were being passed or fought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation on a website, and I did not know anyone in these groups. And now it becomes a time where not only was I interested and I got myself into a place where I met some people, but that the need for the checks and balances are smacking people in the face because everything is becoming more digitized or automated or whatever technology du jour word you want to use. It's right there with you. And it doesn't matter if you're interested in prison reform. You can pick any kind of topic, agriculture, trees. There will be some sensor or some monitor or some something where technology will play a role in that. And while that may not seem important in the maybe a job that you have, when you read the way people write legislation, they can really do great good or great harm depending on how they verbalize technology in the proposed legislation. I think that's the easiest way for me to say that. The words that they do lawyer in or the words that they lawyer out make a big impact on people's lives. And that's where we need to have more people understand that it doesn't matter what issue you find to be passionate about, there will be a technology-related part of it. And if you're looking at laws and you want to do some citizen lobbying, you need to be looking in your local area in Europe or Africa or wherever you are. There will what is my technology component to my area of interest, and you'll find a goldmine of ways that you can be more effective in lobbying or catching the people at doing the dirty deals behind the tables, because there's a lot of money in technology. Otherwise, we wouldn't have to be talking about all of this.
There always is. Indeed.
Yeah, makes sense. So, okay, you mentioned a couple of examples with the baby cameras and the social security numbers on a website. So, let's talk about the process. Do you have an active, let's go and look at all these laws or that are about to be passed, or are there people that give you some clues about such and such a company is trying to push this law through, right? And it really needs some good attention, because I think you mentioned there's like 500 to 600 going on at any one point in time. So how do you manage to keep track of all that and find the ones that are being pushed through quickly and all that kind of stuff, right? Are you able to stay on top of that?
So everybody listening, anybody, wherever you are, whatever your local jurisdiction is, you need to look and find what the website is for your local jurisdiction, your leaders, your commissioners, whoever it is that's making the laws, and you need to go through what's probably a clunky website that will not be as flashy as the ones that you prefer to look at. And you will find the legislation proposed there, hopefully. And that's what we do as a group of people. And it's not an organized fashion. We know when the session is, so we know that we should be looking a few weeks ahead of time to see if someone's pre-filed something. And then if we use our library skills, we're looking for certain keywords. So you might say cybersecurity would be a keyword, or things like that. And we then ask the website to pull up all the bills in this area. And so that's an easy way of looking to see if there seems to be something relevant. And you just have to really just go through them one at a time. There's no easier way. It is time consuming. And then when you find something, then we will bring it to the group or put it on our action list, or I'll just send Scott a message and say, did you see this? It's like that, you know, and then we just start from there.
And there's a lot of interpersonal and kind of networking stuff. It's kind of like, if you see something of interest, you build that kind of network, not a literal technology network, but just a collection of people that say, hey, we like this kind of legislation. If you see anything of concern, send it our way and let us have a look at it.
Yeah, starting out from scratch, as Chuck was talking about, it's a matter of one person can go to the website and do some searches and find something, and something's better than nothing. And then as you find more people and more people find out about what your organization is trying to do, they will actually start reaching out to you. You'll have friends who say, who read an article in the paper, they know that's an area of interest to you. They'll call you and say, hey, did you see that so-and-so over here is doing something you should, based on what you said, you might be interested in looking at, and I'll go check it out. And so we essentially get more eyes and ears over time through that networking that Scott was talking about. That's how we find out about things, as well as our own research going into it. Yeah. And over time, you develop that group. It doesn't start out of the gate, but if you do anything, however little, it's more than nothing. And that starts the snowball down the hill, hopefully.
Okay, excellent. No, that sounds like a good case to, as you say, it's a growing network of people rather than putting a lot of technology in this case. One more question from me, and then I'll leave it to Chris. In the UK and Europe, there are a lot of government contracts that go out to tender and all this kind of stuff. Right? I don't know if you have the same in the UK, but is that something that you would cover in your work as well, or is there a different organization that does that? Because as you may suspect or know, lots of these contracts are written in a certain way to favor certain directions, areas, preferences, vendors, you know what I mean? It's so is that something that you would cover, or is that something that you're more interested in the legal aspects to protect people?
Well, government contracts, the kind of contracts that can be led by government are controlled by the law. So in a sense, they are connected. I think we did look at this kind of situation with some of the concerns on the voting technology that we have in Georgia. And, you know, at first we were looking at the law and we were critiquing the law. And then it got to the point where they had passed a law that wasn't that great. And so it goes down into the purchasing phase. And so once you're down in the purchasing phase, then you are looking at the contracts and things like that. I don't know. It's not so much that we scrutinize the contracts, because once a law is passed, the state has a certain amount of flexibility to kind of do those deals behind the public's back. Right. And they can shield some things from public view, but there was some public participation, especially with the voting machine purchases, and so we were watching it to the extent that we could.
Okay, is there a case to try and make that more open, that part of the process, or?
Well, that's a bigger problem than just a technology problem. Yeah. That's the entire scope of purchasing in general goes above and beyond technology. And I think if we have a particular example or a particular item or a particular aspect that we can work on, we can try to do that. But it's all about procurement and government procurement. Those processes and procedures are much older than the kind of technology laws we've had for the last couple of decades. But what will happen sometimes is as they move from a paper process to an electronic process, then maybe some stuff gets kind of lost in translation, or they don't really capture the spirit of what the law was when they moved to an electronic process. So that's another opportunity to kind of look at the process and see if they're really doing what they should do. But again, procurement is such a large, it's such a huge area that we would be swamped if we tried to take on all of it. So we have to pick and choose what's in our interest area. There's plenty of other laws out there that I think have to do with social justice or other kinds of justice that are just kind of out of our area. And we have limits to what you can do. So I think you have to make decisions about what's really in your interest area and what you can actually do or what you can actually accomplish, given that it's a volunteer organization and you're not 40 hours a week or however many hours a week. People have day jobs and you do what you can do.
There are some times we do get involved with the purchasing process, but it's not direct, meaning we don't insert ourselves into the bidding process or the request for a proposal or any of that sort of thing. Where we do get involved, however, are things like two good examples are Clearview, which is a facial recognition company that was going out and courting police departments to use their product, and it was skirting Fourth Amendment laws. And so we did get involved with that, and where we saw police departments were doing that, we would go and talk to police departments or work with other groups that were talking to police departments in regards to using facial recognition. Another one is a product that we're working on right now in trying to stop, actually, is a product called ShotSpotter. And that's a gunshot detection system that is being sold and deployed within here in Georgia in several locations. And it has some very onerous side effects that have already been noticed in other jurisdictions outside of Georgia. And there are several legal cases regarding it. So we do get involved in that sense, and that sometimes vendors come to law enforcement in particular and say, hey, we've got this great surveillance technology. You should really buy this. And they do their sales pitch and they buy it. And it wasn't a process of legislation putting it in place, but now they're deploying this technology amongst us and using it for law enforcement. And in some cases, those methodologies you're using violate the law. And so we have to go against that and work through legislation in some cases or through other organizations to try to help with that. And that's where Electronic Frontiers Georgia, since it does deal with privacy and security, isn't necessarily always focused on just legislation.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So, just for the listeners that are not from the US, can you explain the shot technology to us, because that's something.
ShotSpotter is that's the actual name of a product. It is a web of microphones that are deployed in an area, like they'll put them on light poles and things like that. Yeah. It goes back to a centralized location at the corporation, ShotSpotter Corporation, where artificial intelligence monitors the audio that it hears and says, hey, I just heard a noise that sounds like a gunshot. And then based on which microphones heard it at which time, they can do audio triangulation to say where it probably occurred. Assuming it says, hey, I think I got something, it passes it to a human operator who purportedly reviews it and says, yes, that was a shot. They notify the police. The police then go and respond to it as a shot's fired. Now, it has some rather interesting side effects. For instance, if you've got an area where there's a general higher level of crime than normal, and you've got the police responding to what's considered a shots fired situation, they're on high alert, they've got guns drawn, and it may be a false alarm. In fact, that's part of the problem, is the false alarm rate for ShotSpotter is extremely high, on the order of like 80%. So, and that level, how much that number is being debated right now. The company is saying, no, it's not that high. And there's other court cases saying, no, it's even higher than 80%. So there's the cost factor of deploying the police regularly for false alarms. There's the issue that when they do arrive, it's like a SWAT team arriving with guns drawn, and it's a completely innocent situation. When people are in a heightened situation with guns drawn, bad things, trademark, can happen. So all of that's wrapped up in that fuzzy, wobbly ball of mess that's called ShotSpotter.
Sounds expensive to me, a false positive.
It's not cheap, and that's part of the thing, is it's determining, for instance, would that kind of technology be a good idea if it worked properly? Well, if you think about it from a technical perspective, yeah, that might be an interesting thing. And since I do have opportunity to talk to police departments, I could see where that would be really useful for them. If it could actually tell them this is roughly when and where a shot occurred, and they could respond to something as opposed to waiting for somebody in the neighborhood who heard it to call them, that would be kind of a good thing. But on the other hand, do you really want a network of microphones placed throughout your neighborhoods that records everything that's being said within earshot?
Yeah, if you're Google or Amazon, probably yes.
Yeah, and so
if
that's,
you're not Google or Amazon, probably not, no.
Exactly, and that's, so that's one of the ramifications is people said, oh, this is a great idea. And they say, really? Do you want them recording the conversations you're having in your front yard with your wife? And it's like, no, maybe not.
Unless you're selling ads or something, that's okay. But if you're not, too bad.
Yeah, and so that's the kinds of unintended consequences they didn't think of. And then there's the issue of the AI. There's a case, I don't remember exactly where. If anybody wants, they can always contact PFGA and I can give them the info. There's a case where a guy was actually prosecuted and I think convicted over based on evidence provided by ShotSpotter. And they're treating ShotSpotter as if it's in courts, as if it's a fingerprints or DNA, that it's absolutely certain.
Well, evidence is.
But it's not. It's AI says, I think, and then an operator says, well, based on my best judgment, it might be. And, well, that's not the same thing as a fingerprint.
And so. Let me guess, the software isn't open source and hasn't been vetted.
Oh, no, it is definitely not open source. It's very proprietary.
There you go. Exactly.
No, it isn't open source. And not only that, it's not transparent. I mean, when you said something about the money, we don't really know. There are sometimes you hear a figure, but we don't really know, like, how much things are costing to deploy. There's a lot that people don't really know. This was, in our particular area, it was... I guess you would call it like an underwriting. It was piloted by a local utility and in a small area. And to my knowledge, there wasn't any kind of citizen input as to whether or not you would even like to be the test piloted area. It was just something that was decided to do. And that's not something that... It was so problematic that they pulled some funding on it, I believe is what they did here where we are, because they were seeing some of the court cases pop up around the country and there was probably some pushback as things go. But regardless, we don't have enough information about something like this to really say that it's a useful tool. And my slogan, when they say defund the police, I have a sense that people would not like to be in a place where there were not police because it might be kind of nice to have some around. But so the slogan that I came up with was not defund the police, defund police technology is what my slogan is because that's where the problems occur. The people that are doing things have common sense and most of the time and can have some training, but the technology, the AI that's listening to something, I'm the kind of person to be like, well, we wouldn't have that problem. We just pulled the plug on that machine over there because the guy that I just talked to sounded like he had some common sense and would, have followed, the rule book that was that he had in front of him. And so because we don't have transparency about it and we don't have good information as to why you think this would be important, and we've got pushback from legal cases that show that it screws up, I can't understand why anybody would want to fund it in the first place without requiring that to take place. But that's kind of where we are right now with it.
Guys, this has been more than interesting. Unfortunately, we have a time limit, but rest assured, this is the first part of a 100-part mini-series on the EFF and the greater surroundings. No, guys, I'm joking. Before we finish off, of course, there's a little format that we call the Poxes of the Week. The Picks of the Week, the Poxes. I'm losing it. Martin, because you have a time constraint, why don't you go first? Scott, Keith, and Chuck is essentially what we do with the boxes is we name something that crossed our mind worth mentioning. Can be anything. Legislation, movies, books, music, wild ideas. So, Martin, why don't you go first, and then the guys can take it. And I go last.
Sure, yeah, under the spirit of anything goes, I'm going to go with storms because we had about three or four in succession in the last week, which is quite unusual even for the small
storms. Island. Of course, not being the software, but rather the weather phenomena, I suppose.
Indeed, yeah, just like high velocity winds. And it just kind of makes you realize that, you know, we have much technology, but nothing like the force of nature that can put it all in small pieces.
Especially if you're living on an island, like some of us do.
It does make it slightly more risky.
Yes. Guys, over to you. Chuck, who wants to go first? Keith, Scott?
So what is it that was something that just crosses our mind?
Anything worth mentioning, yes.
Anything worth mentioning.
Apart from Trump. Sorry, of course, no, you can include Trump if you want to.
No. So I love to see films from around the world because, you know, it's kind of like a passport to another country. And I guess in the spirit of what conversation and the jokes and everything that we've been having, I'm going to say Super Amigos. This is a film by Arturo Perez Torres. It's a Mexican film. And it's really fun to see because you just have to go and check it out. Maybe you can Google it.
I thought you said the Three Amigos a moment ago. I remember that one.
Nope. Super Amigos. It's like Super Friends in English, but it is by Arturo Perez Torres. T-O-R-R-E-S.
Links will be in the show notes, I suppose. Or link with me in the show notes.
Okay.
Keith, Scott, you next.
Yeah. You mentioned during the interview, you mentioned Software Freedom Conservancy. One of the reasons I like to do interviews is because I learn things, and I hadn't actually heard of either. I hadn't heard of Software Freedom Conservancy, or I had forgotten about it. So I went and looked it up, and this is really interesting. So thanks for mentioning that. So Software Freedom Conservancy looks like it was established in 2006 with the backing of the Software Freedom Law Center. That's really interesting. I'll dig into that a little bit more, but thanks for mentioning that. I hadn't heard of that, or if I had, I had forgotten it.
Links absolutely will be in the show notes. Keith, over to you.
Well, one thing that's I've been thinking about quite a bit, actually, as a result of COVID, is we've done a lot of remote meetings like we're having now. And in some cases, like when we have a DC-404 meeting or a 2600 meeting, we have people who are in their area trying to do something similar, and they'll join our meeting. So we've had people from all over the world join in on our meetings. And it's been a great addition to have these people from all over with similar interests join in. And I realized that when we go back to eventually having our physical meetings, that we're going to lose that input and lose that sharing, mind sharing. And so I've been thinking about ways that we can continue having that while still having a physical meeting. Now, this raises some, speaking of side effects, it raises some interesting side effects. DC-404, which is a chapter of DEF CON, which is the largest hacking conference in the world, some of the people that show up wear a tinfoil hat. Let's just put it that way. Not everybody, but some do. And to a point where we had a reporter show up at one of our meetings, and nobody seemed to have any problem with that. We announced that there was a reporter there to observe the meeting. And then toward the end of the meeting, the reporter asked if they could take any photographs. Now, we realized that some people might be sensitive to this issue. So we said, hey, the reporter would like to take a few photographs. We'll stage the area. So if you do not want to be in the photograph, we'll make sure that you're not in the area. And just saying that, two people stood up, took their backpacks, and walked out of the room.
Fair enough.
And so there are some people that are extremely sensitive to that idea. The fact that everybody in the room had a cell phone camera and regularly take pictures without asking any permission whatsoever, and how many security cameras they walked by getting there, seemed to be irrelevant in the conversation. But that idea that they're very sensitive to that is an issue. So when looking at a physical meeting and a hybrid meeting where people are coming in from the outside and you don't know who they are or where they're coming from, how do we share that? How do we create a hybrid meeting that allows people remotely to join us in those meetings? This has another benefit in that, like now, we're from all over the world having this conversation. how do we allow people to join in a conversation and do presentations at our meeting who aren't physically present? Normally, we can only draw on the people who live within Atlanta. Well, we'd like to draw on the world. So how do we solve that problem? And so I've been talking to Scott and several others about the technology to do that. The next problem is, how do we make that technology accessible? What I might consider a minor purchase here might be a month's person's wage in another country. And we want to make it so that this technology or this idea is accessible so that anybody from anywhere with limited skill set and limited access to funds would be able to join in and be participant in it. So that's what we've been thinking about.
So your POX would be like BBB as Big Blue Button or Jitsi or something?
The solution, one of the part of the solution is we're considering using Big Blue Button. It's free. The upside of Big Blue Button is it is open source, it is free, but there's no online service hosting it for free. So that means if you want to use it, you must host your own instance. Now, in our case, we have a person here in Atlanta as part of DC44 who hosts it on his service. He has a commercial hosting service, and he hosts it for us for free. He also hosts that for the EFGA. We also and 2600. He hosts all of those on his server, and that was a generous thing for him to do. But that's not necessarily accessible to everybody. There's another open source product called Jitsi that does provide hosting for free. And so we're looking at things that lower the bar for everybody. And we would suggest, I happen to like Big Blue Button for a number of reasons. For instance, it makes it very easy to save the chat, whereas there are other options that make it very difficult to do that. So yeah, there's a lot of technology involved here in how we do it, and also maintain the privacy and the security, the people actually physically attending the meeting, that if they don't want to be known by those not in the room, we'll accommodate that as best we can too. So that's kind of mixing all of that together is going to be difficult, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, funny that you mentioned that, Keith, because here in Germany, there are quite a few institutions that offer a free BBB instance for the public domain. And I'm that sure that there must be something similar in the US too. It's just a matter of research and finding it.
Wow, I'd be very interested in finding it. I did look for it and didn't find anything. So now that I know they're in Germany, that gives me a place to look at. It's possible they have outlets here that do the similar thing. Or a company in Germany might also do it here.
The Chaos Computer Club at least once run, as far as I can recall, runs at least one free instance of BBB. I'm not too sure about the details, but more than happy to put you in touch with them.
I know the Chaos Computer Club. I go and watch their presentations online. I have not been able to attend in person. It has been a goal of mine to do so. In fact, many, many years ago, I was invited by another speaker to go with him to that one of their events, and I wasn't able to go, and I wish I could have, but I did.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm definitely aware of them. I watch their presentations online. They have some excellent presentations. There's one in particular about anonymity online and how it's a double-edged sword. It was very, very good. Mm.
Yeah, they normally run a Chaos Communication conference or something like this
between
Christmas and New Year, and this is really worth checking out. Links may be in the show notes.
They also publish articles online. They're very
good. They do, yes. Also in English and German. And that nicely leads us to my POXes, or my POX rather, is actually more than one at the moment. Not at the moment, but rather in general for this week. Almost tempted, and this is a first on Linux In-Laws. The POX, or my POX of the week, is actually the American Constitution, as I mentioned this earlier. But I'm tempted But rather than quoting it, I'm tempted to just mention their author. So with all further ado, and this is, of course, a world premiere. So let's go ahead. It's James Madison, Richard Henry Lee, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, James Wilson, Roger Scheman, John Dickinson, Governor Morris, George Mason, Elbridge Gerry,
James McHenry, Rufus King, James Pinckney, William Patterson, Hugh Williamson, William Livingston, George Reed, Jonathan Dayton, William Bloomfield, Thomas Fitzsimpsons, Irishman, John Langdon, Nicholas Gilman, William Samuel Johnson, Gunning Bedford, Daniel of St. James Cheeson, I think, Pierce Butler, another Irishman, Tom Smithin, Robert Boris, Charles Cosworth, Richard Bassett, Emma Pendleton, Luther Martin, not King, but just Luther Martin, Caleb Strong, William Jackson, Edmund Randolph, John Marshall, and that's it. Guys, you're probably not listening, but thanks to a great piece of legislation, still living on, still going strong, you could have done much, much worse.
And if anybody's interested in hearing the behind-the-scenes discussions, so to speak, that led to it, and the debates over the ideas that led to what was eventually codified in the Constitution, go look up the Federalist Papers and read them.
Yes, I absolutely advise you. Of course, the Constitution is online. The links will be in the show notes. These people knew what they were doing, tempted to add. And with that, people, Keith, Scott, and Chuck, thank you very much for being here. It has been more than interesting, and we are really looking forward to having you on the show soon once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Guys, thank you. This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge,
but stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts. We normally record about 4 to 6 hours, depending. We normally then cut this down to about 2 hours. Exactly. And HPR sends this further down to 1 hour or 45 minutes. No, I'm joking, guys.
I've never had anybody honor the Constitution by reading all of the authors off. I feel like I did something very special.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny how the Europeans seem to know more about the Constitution than the average American on the street. Always kind of
yeah,
sad.
That's sad. It's gratifying but sad.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.